Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Just double, triple checking. Okay. And apparently let me burp my coffee out. Okay, hold on. Okay, there we go. Stop being gross. From Luminary, this is Here to Slay, the Black Feminist, just a touch gross when I'm recording before 9 a.m., therapeutic podcast of your dreams. I am Tressie McMillan Cottom, y'all.
And I'm Roxanne Gay. On Here to Slay, Tressie and I talk about our problems. And by problems, I mean everything from racist, vote-suppressing Republicans and weak-kneed Democrats who do nothing to the student loan debt that increases with every moment and goes unaddressed by the president. And, of course, global warming that is boiling our planet.
You know, just the regular things. We also like to talk about our personal problems, Roxanne. Although I would suggest that most of our personal problems are other people.
Right?
I don't have problems. Mm-hmm. I tell you, I ain't got problems. Now, we have people, and people tend to come with problems, like our mothers. God love them. God love them. I have my mother with me right now on vacation, and I did that to myself, so I can't even blame her.
That was a choice.
We talk about good times, fine dining, travel, all of that good stuff. Speaking of which, I'm hungry right now.
I certainly know a thing or two about hunger. But when we're not working out our food options,
I see what you did there.
We also bring in someone else to talk with. Women, mostly. Black women, usually. Women in the arts, politics, media. Women who are getting shit done.
Like us.
Hey, girl.
Hey.
Hey, West Coasty.
I know, and I've been here just long enough where I'm not jet lagged, but I'm definitely not on East Coast time anymore, but not completely on West Coast. So I'm a little loopy, but I'm definitely closer to your time zone than I usually am.
I am glad to hear that. I have enjoyed watching the images on Instagram. It seems like an ideal trip to the Pacific Northwest.
Yep.
It just looks lovely.
Yeah, so we're splitting the difference. This is a mother-daughter trip. So let me tell you what this is. This is me preempting my mother's request to do something. So see, I have to jump out there ahead of her desires. So part of your job as a daughter of a Black mother is anticipating what she needs.
Amen.
Okay, so I knew she wanted to do something, and I knew if I let her decide, she'd want to do it at the worst possible time. You know, the beginning of the semester, or, you know, going into the holiday season. So this was me forcing her hand on a trip when it was most convenient for me, and when I could still have some input over what we were doing. So, yes, I've taken my mother to the Pacific Northwest, which I really liked. I thought it would be like a good compromise between like being in LA or California with some of more of what I enjoy, which is a little bit more outdoor stuff, but still enough shopping for Vivian. Because let's be real, what my mother wants to do is she wants to shop and she wants to eat, right? So we needed a combination of those two things, and the Pacific Northwest fit the bill nicely. Mm-hmm. We went out to Bainbridge Island earlier this week, and I've decided to move there, Roxanne.
Bainbridge looks gorgeous.
I absolutely freaking love it. And one of the things that I found fascinating is I have friends who live in Martha's Vineyard. Mm-hmm. And so I've done Martha's Vineyard several summers at my friend's insistence. And I really hope she doesn't hear this, by the way. Listen, I like Martha's Vineyard. Mm-hmm. And I'm supposed to like Martha's Vineyard. For our listeners who don't know, Martha's Vineyard is like the gold standard of Black bougie leisure. Right. So Black bougie people love to go to Martha's Vineyard. It's absolutely a status symbol, all of that good stuff. And Bainbridge reminds me of Martha's Vineyard, but somehow feels a little bit more welcoming. And so I said, I know everybody's getting ready to be mad at me. Listen, I like Martha's Vineyard. I do. It's bougie, capital B.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I feel the need to have on an outfit when I'm at Martha's Vineyard. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
And outfits to me aren't vacation.
You know, they aren't. And I also, I haven't been to Martha's Vineyard either because it looks so bougie. And I'm not afraid of bougie, to be clear.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. Listen. It,
but it's not my kind of bougie.
Yes.
It's like, I don't want to get on a boat. I don't want to have to wear seersucker.
It's a lot.
You know, I'm not trying.
Oh, girl, so much seersucker.
I mean, it's just too much. I'm like, y'all keep that. It's fine.
And I love us, but all of the girls with the hair, they're on the beach, but they still have the hair, you know? And again, the ensembles. And I just, you know.
It's so much. So, they're putting in that work.
So I love my people, but Bainbridge Island is very much environmentally, like, very much like Martha's Vineyard. Small, cute downtown, but still enough of the stuff you want. They got a cute little museum. They've got enough restaurants where you won't get bored with the food. And you can get around the island really easily, but nobody had on an outfit. And I think that's why I feel really comfortable there. So I love Bainbridge. Mother loves Seattle and is dragging me all across this place, going from boutique to boutique. So I think both of us got what we needed out of this place. The other reason I chose it is because the COVID rates were doing pretty good here.
I was going to ask, with all the sort of, because you seem to be doing the most. And after I saw that picture of that dude with his leg up on the railing, airing himself out, I was just like, I wonder what COVID is like up there.
He was airing out his balls. I mean, he was just like,
I am free to be me.
And he kept it there the whole time. I kept clocking him because I was like, how long is he going to do it? Okay, so he's got his leg propped up, y'all, on the ferry banister. And he was looking around. I mean, he wanted you to look.
I mean, he clearly did. He was preening. Yeah. I'm sorry, but.
Right. The picture was not a secret, by the way.
Thing needed to be seen.
I looked directly at him. I pointed the camera and kind of nodded at him like, okay. And he smiled. He smirked. He was into it.
Exhibitionist.
Yes, he kept that leg propped up there that entire ride, airing out that whole situation, which, you know, listen, good for him. It was very performative. But yeah, the COVID rates, I think, are fairly good here. Washington State is a bit of a mixed bag overall because there are some strong conservative-leaning pockets across the state. But Seattle and certainly the places that we've been going have been pretty good. And I paid attention to, you know, how much there was to do outside. So Seattle also had that going for it. We've mostly spent our time outside. So I felt like it was a pretty good compromise. I'm still being cautious, not in lockdown, but still being cautious, which as it turns out, we still need to be very hyper vigilant because
third wave.
The COVID trend lines aren't going the way we hoped they would be going at this point.
I think it's a new normal, a new way of living where sometimes we're going to wear masks in public and sometimes we're not. And my in-laws arrived today. This time with my niece and nephew, Rebecca and Jackson, who are 10 and 13. And so I have planned an extravagant itinerary for the week involving Legoland and Disneyland and Universal Studios. And
as one does.
As one does. It's going to be very summery. We're sending the parents to Hollywood Bowl on a little romantic date. And it's going to be fun. But as I was making all of these plans, I kept thinking, wow, how safe is this? Fortunately, like you, most of what we're doing is actually going to be outdoors. You know, there's this new sense of caution about making plans, and we're hanging out with friends now. We just went to a lovely, lovely wine bar on Sunday. Annette Bening and Warren Beatty walked behind us, and we were like, we just had an A-plus Hollywood sighting.
They're still hanging in there.
They are hanging in there. They are socializing. And, you know, it was great. And we looked around and the restaurant was full. I just kept thinking, things are different. We're trying so hard to pretend everything is normal.
Yeah.
And I wonder how long this is going to last.
Yeah, that is a bit exhausting to me as we've been tentatively making our way back out into the world. The same thing, I went to a sorority function for my sorority last week. I'm going to a concert in Vegas. I'm doing the Usher residency with my sister. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to see Usher, baby. Very tentatively, but I do feel the need to sort of pretend like everything is normal when we're out and about, because you want to squeeze everything out of those moments because they do still feel kind of special. Mm-hmm. And that makes things a little weird. And we wanted to explore some of that weirdness that we think many of us are feeling as we try to get back to the new normal, we might say, in our relationships. A few weeks ago, we had a conversation with a family and marriage therapist, Keandra Jackson, where we talked about what happened to our relationships during COVID, how to maybe restart some of them as we reemerge, and which of those we want to leave behind.
And more recently, we had the wonderful opportunity to explore these questions with another therapist, the one and only Esther Perel. Esther is a psychotherapist, and she specializes in relationships and sexuality and how these things work together or don't. Her most recent book is The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, which is such a great title and a great subject to explore. And she has hosted not one, but two podcasts, How's Work? And Where Should We Begin? Which takes us into her therapy sessions with couples. And I actually listen to, I don't listen to many podcasts, but I do listen to Where Should We Begin? And it's fascinating. It is fascinating.
Which tons of people apparently do. People lost their shit when I said we were speaking with Esther, by the way. They wanted me to bring all of these questions to her. We began our conversation with Esther by asking her, now that we're reemerging from our bubbles, what happened to us collectively? What happened to us? And where do we go from here? What's going on with us, and where do we go next?
We are unsure, but we are unsure of how long we're going to be unsure. And so we are constantly assessing risks, management of risks, fighting over what are the risks that we want to take with the people that we love, but who think differently about those very same risks. And this prolonged uncertainty has also been combined with the state of, I think we could all agree that this is a collective grief that is broad. You know, it's the grief over loss, but loss can be, you know, the death of people, but it's also the death of intangibles, of the way that you've conceived of normality, the death of spontaneity, the curiosity that usually propels us towards others and who now suddenly became, you know, any spontaneous meeting could be a spontaneous contamination. What a crazy thing that is, that we are flipped on ourselves. And the sense of ambiguous loss, the notion of things that are physically present but psychologically absent, like office towers, and people, parents, grandparents, who are emotionally very present and physically absent, and we are unable to see them. That is the ambiguous loss. So it's that kind of stuff that we have really all grappled with, everyone and every community in different ways.
It is interesting that you talk about the scale of loss being varied and variable. I'm working on a piece right now where one of my arguments is that we have a language for the big grief that you're talking about, death, right? And it's not the best language. You know, we don't do it well in the West, but we do at least, we have a language for death and I think sudden trauma. Mm-hmm. I am thinking as much, though, about the loss of the things that comprised our identity. Like our relationships to each other are as much about our everyday identity, who we are in relation to others, what that says about us. Do we have a language? Like, how should we talk about, what is a good way to think about what has happened to our closest relationships, which tend to be the ones that we build the foundation of our own identities on?
It's interesting you ask, because in the middle of the month of April, I went ahead and did a series for Where Should We Begin that was just with couples in lockdown. Nigeria, Sicily, Germany, New York, you know, what was happening to relationships under confinement? Where do people find freedom when they are locked in together? You know, what is the power of the imagination? What are the ways that we negotiate self and other? What stands out around identity is the sense that when you lose your job, you're not only losing income, you lose a part of yourself, you lose your status, you lose your role in society. So identity, who am I, you know, what matters to me, what are my priorities, that gets always shaken up when you have a disaster or a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Disasters are like relationship accelerators. You have mortality that is right behind you. You sense the fragility of life, and suddenly you say, what is important to me? What matters? What are my priorities? Where do I put meaning? And you begin to say, life is short. What am I waiting for? Mm-hmm. And what am I waiting for is about what is essential to who I am. Mm. What must I still do? What must I no longer live with? What decisions have I been holding off making? It's those essential questions of identity that are very much at the forefront when the stakes are all heightened.
Have you noticed anything, a common thread through a lot of the people you've been speaking with about what this relationship accelerator has done to them? Because I think that can either mean good or not so good things, depending on the state of your relationship.
Well, is good about being more clear?
Yeah.
Regardless of the outcome.
Right, right. Yes. Yeah, regardless of the outcome.
Like
exactly.
Having a clear sense of not only who you are, but what you want out of a relationship.
Correct. Or your own responsibility to the relationship as well. Mm-hmm. So in general, there is a sense that if life is short and what am I waiting for, there is often the drive to let's move in together, let's have a child, let's buy that house, let's move to the other side of the country, let's do those things we've been meaning to do. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, it's life is short, I've waited long enough, I'm out of here, I'm not continuing this. This is a compromise that is no longer acceptable to me. So it goes in both directions. At this moment, as we are experiencing a type of a reopening, there is a proliferation of divorces and breakups. I mean, this is not new. Mm-hmm. This is not the first time this is happening in the aftermath of a disaster. But it's about clarity. It's about resolve. It's about mutuality and reciprocity. And it's about responsibility.
We are thinking a lot about what intimacy means in our lives because of the way mortality, as you talk about, is like the wall now up against our backs, or has been for quite some time. And for some of us, that is a more familiar position to be in than it is for other people. I think about how different that feels for some people. Some people live under the threat of life or death decisions.
All the time.
That's exactly. Yeah. Yes. Do we define intimacy the same way, depending on our relationship to risk? And how should we be defining it in our lives?
I actually think that the definition of intimacy is primarily influenced by the way that we conceive of ourselves in an individualistic framework or in a more collectivist framework. What I mean by that is this. For most of history, intimacy has been living life together, sharing the vicissitudes of everyday life, working the land, raising the children, developing companionship, economic support. Intimacy in the modern ideology of love has become into me see.
Into me see.
Intimacy is a discursive experience. It's a communicative experience. It's how we open up in front of each other. It's how I disclose myself in front of you, and you will listen to me, and you will empathize with me, and you will validate me, and you will make me feel that I am not alone. It's intimacy as a bulwark against isolation, atomization, and aloneness. That is pretty much the definition of intimacy in our Western modern romantic arrangement.
You know, it's interesting. When the pandemic started, my wife and I decided to live together for the first time. And at the time, we were not married yet. We were just engaged. And it was interesting to find that level of intimacy later in life. I'm 46, she's 59. And do you have advice for people on how to find intimacy later in life? Because one of the things we learned when we started to live together is that we are really set in our ways, and we are used to managing households alone.
Right. So, I mean, there's various ways to answer this, right? If you take this very same definition of into me see, when you're 25, you sometimes want somebody else to love you so that you can love yourself a little more.
Yeah.
You know, there's a different transaction going on. You don't say that, but that's de facto what you're really hoping for. The big thing that happens, hopefully, with age and maturity is that you've come to know yourself, and hopefully you've also come to accept yourself, and you've come to tolerate the ambivalence of the things you do like and the things you like less. And so when you meet somebody, on the one hand, you have your set ways, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, the nature of your dependence and interdependence may be very different. It's you don't need the other person to agree with you on everything in order to know that you're right, in order to know that what you think was what happened is really what happened. Mm-hmm. You can understand that you have a version and you can coexist with someone who has a different version next to you. And those two shall live side by side perfectly fine. It's that notion that, you know, you can be closer to someone without being afraid of losing yourself. And you can be closer to someone without being afraid of losing them. Mm. You know, the way I like to imagine it is that in many relationships, you will often find that one of us is more afraid with the fear of losing the other, with the fear of abandonment. Mm-hmm. And one of us is more afraid with the fear of losing ourselves, the fear of suffocation. Mm. And it's that dance in a couple.
Oh, wow.
That's the thing that you check right now when you say, you know, I'm older and Debbie is older. That dance, if you ask each other, how was that before in your previous relationships, you may begin to see how it has evolved over mm-hmm. the decades.
The fear of losing oneself. How close can I get to the thing that I desire without losing myself? Can you negotiate that with another person without having figured it out for yourself first, Esther?
I think this is a moving target throughout life. I mean, it's not a static thing. You know, one day you've got it and you hold on mm-hmm. to it.
Right. That's what I'm always hoping for, by the way, because I like to check it off. I want to say I've accomplished this level. I'm now ready for the next step. And so you're telling me I can't check this off.
Tracy, when I, you know, about the fear of losing oneself, I made a mistake about something. And I talked to myself. I said, it's okay. It happened. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to go back and do it better. Mm-hmm. Breathe through this. You know, your whole life isn't destroyed. And I was thinking, as I'm doing this inner dialogue, I'm thinking myself, I'm so glad this didn't happen to me 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would have been at my wit's end for three weeks,
yep.
not sleeping, drinking all the time. I should have, I could have, why didn't I? You
know? Absolutely.
Yes. I used to live those moments over and over again for uh-huh. years. I've got one moment in particular, a professional moment, yeah. Esther, that I didn't let go. This happened to me when maybe I was 24. It was one of my first jobs. And I let a manager call me stupid mm-hmm. in front of the other people in a meeting. And I didn't say anything.
And neither did anybody else.
That's uh-huh. right. Well, that's fair. That's fair, but I only held myself accountable. I mean, I replayed that moment for 20 years. It would come to me in the middle of the night. So I say that to say that's why I'm so obsessed with the fantasy of being able to finally overcome a moment and move on.
But you see, when you obsess, you're saying, mm-hmm. why didn't I say something? And I think that the real shift is to obsess and to say, why didn't nobody say anything? Or at best, why didn't I ask everybody, are you just going to sit here and let that happen?
Yes.
Yeah, you're
absolutely.
Right.
You're right.
You know, because when you're humiliated or ashamed in front mm-hmm. of a whole group, it's the last thing you can do is kind of, you know, pull yourself out
yes.
and say, I have dignity.
Yes, yes.
You know.
Exactly. Do we put too much pressure on our relationships? You mentioned the atomization of modern life, which is something I'm obsessed with, by the way, mm-hmm. because I just don't think we were meant to live this way, or we haven't evolved for this kind of way
no,
of life.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And you talk about how badly we want our romantic relationships in particular to be the bulwark against that. Basically, you're talking about like a fundamental fissure or separation that's happened where we're kind of cut off from collective life. How do we build a life that has intimacy that's not only just about our romantic partners?
That's a great question. So I'll address it with two tacks. Mm-hmm. One is, I do think we put a lot of pressure and expectations into our romantic relationships, mm-hmm. more than we ever have. We still want all the things that we wanted in the past. From mm-hmm. companionship and economic support and family
right.
life. But we also want a best friend and we want mm-hmm. a trusted confidant and we want a passionate lover to boot and we want all of that while
in one person.
While we live twice as long in one person.
Yes, while we live twice as long. I haven't thought of that. That's right.
Twice as
We're
long.
Living so much longer.
So
yeah.
I often say, you know, we are asking one person to give us what once an entire village used to provide. Mm. Mm-hmm. The research of Eli Finkel in his All or Nothing Marriage is very interesting about that, because the people who do manage to climb Mount Olympus are actually having relationships today. The good relationships of today are better than most relationships of history. But the fact is that only a few people can climb the mountain.
Get that. Yeah.
Because the view is more beautiful, but the air is also thinner till you get there. On the other end, what he says is that what allows you to have a better relationship is the diversification of needs. And that means people need friends, people need family, people need neighbors, people need mentors, people need activists that they collaborate with, people need co-creators in their artistic pursuit. They need a village. This idea that one person is going to satisfy all your needs and vice versa is really a tall order for a party of two. And they crumble under the expectations.
That's exactly.
I was going to say, it puts so much pressure. And I can even look at my own romantic history. And for most of my adult life, I did sort of expect to find that all in one.
Right.
And it wasn't until I realized, oh, I can have that kind of friendship over there, and I can get this over here. And then my wife and I can just focus on the things that really matter to us without this unrealistic expectation. And I know a lot of people have found sort of a greater sense of who they are and what they want in the pandemic. What are we doing to move forward with everything that we've gained and come to understand about intimacy in our relationships, regardless of what decisions we've decided to take?
So when you were talking about these expectations, one of the big things that has changed is that in 1960, 80% of people in their 20s were married. Today, 20% in their 20s are married. In the US, what does it mean is that you have a moratorium, a period from about 18 to 28, 29, 30, where people are in nomadic relationships. They move from one relationship to another. With one day, the hope that they will meet the soulmate. And the soulmate, for most of history, has always been God. It hasn't been another person.
Yeah, I felt that one profoundly.
You know, and this is a Jungian analyst, Robert Johnson, who explained it really well. You know, people want in their relationship, they want transcendence and meaning and ecstasy and wholeness. All these existential spiritual needs that people used to look for in the realm of the divine.
Wow.
And romantic love now has become this religion.
Yes.
And that is a real challenge. So, and I don't think the pandemic has changed any of that. What the pandemic maybe could help us with is to understand that love is not a permanent state of enthusiasm. It's a verb. It's an active verb. For example, it was very easy when people are in confinement together to just start snapping at each other and just noticing the stuff that annoys us. Because normally you could go and say this to somebody else, you know, and then you're gone for 8 hours and then you come back home and then you've had time to kind of breathe and be seen by other people. And the stuff that annoyed you in the morning is kind of dissolved a little bit at best. At this moment, you know, everything collapsed. All our roles collapsed in one place, right? You are the cook and you are the your owner of your gym and you are a teacher and you are a parent and a friend and a child of and a colleague and a CEO and whatever else and a podcaster. All of this generally without even having to change clothes, go anywhere or change seat.
Exactly.
And while that happens, what I found myself doing a lot is telling people, you have got to do active what you would call intimacy, right? Intimacy, gestures of appreciation. And the appreciation isn't just, you know, thanks for bringing the coffee. The appreciation is thanks for being so thoughtful.
Right, right. Yeah.
Because then you see the person rather than just the action, the gesture.
They,
the
they're not providing you a service.
That's right.
But to recognize the emotional care that the service has done.
Also, don't pretend that you know everything about the person just because they're next to you. And then you start to have the most boring conversations. When you talk with your friends, you're
curious. I hate that life stage. Yeah, I hate that life. That relationship stage, I should say. When you're, all your conversations are about, and then I had lunch. And you know, they didn't even bring me my lunch at work. And then it's like this laundry list reporting of your day. And I'm like, what happened? Didn't we used to talk about, like, I don't know, politics or climate change. We used to talk about like these really big ideas or really deep intimate things. And some stage happens in a relationship where it's just a laundry list of items.
So I had a very fun experience last night, right? part of what I try to do in response to this, you know, languishing, as we all like to call it right now, and lack of curiosity and interest, was that I created a game.
Yes, the game.
And I played last night. So the game is called Where Should We Begin? Like the podcast, but it's a game of stories, because that's it. What your conversation is a list of items.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the same as the conversation. That's a story where then you're interested. Then you look up and you want to hear what happened, you know.
Right.
And I played, we were eight of us, and I played with my husband, and he got a card that asked him about something in his, you know, when he was young. And he started telling a story. We are almost 40 years together. I had never heard it.
Yes.
Then you say, wow, you know, the person who is next to you is forever somewhat unknown, mysterious, and elusive. Mm-hmm. If you can allow yourself to actually remain curious rather than to be made anxious by that, because you think that by now I should have figured you all out and I should know before you talk what you're about to say, and then I can complain about boredom.
And we have this cultural narrative that it's really important to know everything about your partner. But I certainly hope I don't ever know everything about my partner, because then where's the mystery? What is left to talk about if you can't discover new things in each other?
Correct. This is a paradox that we live with, right? On some level, the unknown for some of us brings curiosity, mystery, anticipation, desire.
Yes.
For some of us, the unknown is more connected with fear, with anxiety, with unsettledness, etc.
Okay.
I think that got intensified in this whole past year, for sure. Because for the first time, this unknown was actually life-threatening. This unknown was people who didn't know if they should protect their family or go to work. This unknown was, if I come too close to you, what could happen to me? And then we would go out and then we would come back and say, oh, shit, I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't have done this. You know, it's like, what am I going to pay for this? And then you count the days. And then, you know, everyone went through various phases, you know, like that, more or less. Even if they went to the denial of it. The denial of it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that you're willing to suppress it. So the paradox for me is it's an existential reality that we all have two fundamental sets of human needs. We all want security, stability, predictability, reliability in life and in our relationships. And we also all want freedom and openness and change and novelty and risk in our relationships. And I often call it the tension between love and desire. Because in love, you want to know, you want to narrow the distance, you want to minimize the tension. But in desire, you actually don't want to go to something that is foregone conclusion.
Yes, right.
Why bother if you know in advance where it's going to take you all the time?
Right.
You want the experience of something new happen to you, something even to yourself, you know. So these two, they relate and they conflict. And herein lies the mystery of eroticism. And some of us come out of our childhood wanting more freedom and wanting more novelty and change. And some of us come out of our childhood having had so much unchange and so much chaos.
Right. We just want a little corner.
Something calm and steady.
Yes.
Exactly. And we tend to mate with a person who is often on the other side.
That's the part I'll never figure out.
Yeah.
We are attracted to that person who wants the exact opposite of what I think we secretly crave.
But they are attracted to the part of us that we would like to leave a little behind. It goes both ways.
Okay.
And there's more of that tension.
Yes, because you offer me some structure. You offer me reliability. You offer me solid. You offer me, you know, dependability. And I offer you to stretch a little bit beyond your boundaries, to look outside, to be more curious, to be more expansive, to take risks. And trust and risk, they are in a dance with each other in permanence.
How did you even come up with an idea to create a game to talk about developing intimacy with other people?
The first part of the pandemic, I was doing a lot of YouTube series on love, loss, and loneliness in lockdown. Then I did a whole season of couples in lockdown for Where Should We Begin, the podcast. Then I went to look at the hard conversations that people are craving to have at work in the Housework podcast. And then I said, there is another side to this. This is the serious part. But there is an antidote to that seriousness, mm-hmm. and that is playfulness. That is the way that we do remain connected with our aliveness, with our vibrancy, with our vitality. And I want to create something about that. It's not enough just for me to say we need to be more playful. I want to create an experience of that playfulness. I missed my dinners. I missed my friends. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I want to create an experience that allows us to remain connected like that. And little did I know that it evolved to the perfect timing of the re-entry and the re-entry mm-hmm. anxiety and the way that we need to now deal with the social atrophy that we have experienced. And so it became a game to connect and to reconnect. Mm-hmm. So the game is, if you're on a first date, that you can play it. It has a whole deck of just sexuality questions, which you can take out if you want to go mm-hmm. to work or keep uh-huh. in. If you want. It's about the best friends, but it's also about people who are just meeting. I mean, I've now tried it just yesterday. It was a whole group of people. Many of us had never met. And mm-hmm. we really left everyone remembering not so much what we ate, but every story we heard. Mm. We live through stories. Our relationships yes. are a story. Mm-hmm. We tell our lives through stories. We yep. remember people through stories. And I thought that if we stay connected to those stories, we will stay connected to our aliveness and our vitality.
Mm-hmm. You know, I come from a storytelling, I like to say a storytelling people, my family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My father's side of the family does competitive storytelling is what I call it. You know, which story can beat the person's story, but the other person's story, who has the right version of the story. And the idea, until you said it just now, it's like, oh yeah, that's what we do. We're playing like a competitive story game.
Play gives you a container. Play uh-huh. gives you just enough structure to then be able to be spontaneous. When you play, okay. you can tell a story without realizing you're telling the story because you would never have told the story if somebody had just asked you the question. But it's framed right. in the game. It's a kind mm-hmm. of a space in suspension. We're playing.
Well, speaking of games, Tressie, do you want to play?
Maybe. Do you play fair?
I always, no.
See, I know my friend is a poker player, so I have to ask questions. No, let's play. Let's go, girly. Let's go.
Okay, let's see. This is, yeah, I'm going to actually go with the first question.
Okay.
I would quit my job if you'd pay me to.
Okay. It's not going to be at all what people expect. Because, you know, there's a certain stage we get to in our careers. Everybody expects you to quit your job, mm-hmm. by the way. And that came a calling for me like over this past year. People are asking me. And I said, no, I'm not quitting my job. You know, if anything, I don't need my job now. So it's a whole lot more fun. But there is one thing I would quit my job to do. And it's not at all what I presently do. I don't even know if this is a real job. But if there was something where my life was connecting people, the thing I really love, it happened this week. A friend of mine wants to relocate. And you know, I'm all over that. Oh. Let me do all the research for your new place. Let me introduce you. I'm in a network of realtors. I've got a guy who'll help you with this. I'll set up the exploratory tour. Here's a notebook of some things you need to consider. I made her a notebook. I love, and then I want to walk away. I don't want to actually have you, you know, be there when you buy the house. I just want to get you all set up to make the best decision of your life, introduce you to the people to help you, and then I walk away. That's not a job is my problem. It's probably something, as Esther pointed out earlier, it's probably something that used to happen in a village context where you would know people and you'd have these really deep relationships. But we don't have that anymore. And I love doing that for people. Like, let me sort out your stuff.
You want to be like a house hunter, but like a house hunter concierge.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I really do. Again, the problem
you
is that.
You would be so good at that job.
Girl, I thought I thrived at it this week.
I set up pictures lunch with you dates. And your friend. Yes. I was like, you are setting up this house. You are letting her get yep. to know the community.
That's right. I set up different lunch sites so she could see different parts of town and experience the walkability of the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I wanted her to see what her commute would be like. So we had something mid-morning. Oh, I thought it all through and I had a blast.
But you know what, Tressie, is also that you were in a full-blown daydreaming. You got to fantasize a whole other
exactly
life without
right.
having to change an iota about yours.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that's right, the trade-off between security and freedom. That's
yes.
right. I got to play in her life.
That's right.
And then come home to my nice, safe little house, which I adore. I love my safe little house bubble. I call it my bubble. You're exactly right. I said, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, and I had a ball. It was like I'd taken a vacation.
Of course.
I was so refreshed from it.
I went. I came back. And I had to do nothing.
Except my favorite part.
Fantasize. Yeah.
That is my absolute favorite part. I had to do absolutely nothing. All right, my friend, your turn. You're up. Okay. Okay. From your teenage point of view.
So this is the prompt card.
Okay. Right?
From your teenage point of view.
Okay. That's the prompt.
That's going to be the lens through which you're going to tell the story.
Okay. This is a dream you've never shared.
Oh, from my teenage point of view. You know, a dream I never shared from high school. I went to a high school with people who were very athletic. And we had to take gym every single year, and we had to do actual sports. So I was like, I was on the little prep crew team, things like that. Things I had no aptitude for and no interest in. Mm-hmm. But I always dreamed of being one of the athletes on the varsity teams and having like the letter jacket and more than that, having the physical competence to be that person to like run the cross country race or play on the hockey team, because my little stint with the hockey was not good. And
you have a hockey stint.
I did, because it's New England. And I've done hockey, I've done lacrosse, I've done field hockey. There is nothing I have not tried. And I just always dreamed of like really being competent at it and being good at it, because I was kind of like, at least academically, good at everything else. And this was not the thing I was good at. And I knew, and everyone else around me knew. And so, that would have been a little dream.
They do seem like they're having so much fun.
They do. And like, they seemed like so at ease in their bodies.
Right. And well adjusted.
That was like when my very fucked up relationship with my body began, where I was like, I don't want anything to do with it. This is not my problem. I am in my head and my body is a vehicle. And to see these people who would like just run up and down a field for 75 minutes playing football or whatever, I just always was very envious of it because I also had brothers who were incredibly athletic. One of them played professional soccer or football, depending on the country you're in. And so I just thought, that's never going to be me, but I sure wish it could.
There is a little bit of a myth as well, huh, that the people who are the athletes have a fundamentally positive relationship to their body. That is not necessarily the case either.
But that's true.
It looks like it on the other side. You can do all those things. You're nimble, you move, you're in your body.
And what's interesting is, as an adult, I realize how many of those people were pressured into playing those sports. It was really their parents that encouraged it, or their communities, and they had when they graduated, they never returned
to
that
sport. At least they liked it when they started, but they stopped liking it after all the pressure.
I think we tend to idealize realities that are not ours, and what, at least for me, I always like look at people like who are super athletic, and I just think, oh, your life is perfect. Don't cry to me. And I know now, of course, as an adult, that that's not the case. Like, people are complicated. Life is complicated, and so are bodies. So,
which is why this game would be so much fun. People are complicated, and that's what we're supposed to be discovering about each other, right?
I think so.
They're complicated. Sometimes they're just filled with contradictions. Sometimes they're just so funny and absurd. Sometimes they're just so tender and moving. I mean, actually, it really covers the range of... do you have another one?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a few questions, actually. We would love to ask you a question.
All right.
Let's see. Share something risky.
So that's our prompt card. I get it now. So sharing something risky is the prompt, the context. Okay. Taking a risk. Yes.
I've never shared the whole story about the time.
I have never told the whole thing. Oh, God, there's so many. I used to have a lot of fake IDs. I had a fake student ID that went well into my late 20s, and it was still by handwriting, so I would just change the numbers from one to two to three. And I actually got caught. And I got caught in a tiny, tiny village as I was traveling in Turkey. And I was trying to go to an archaeological site, and of all places, the guy looks at the card and he says, "This is not a real card."
At the archaeological site.
But in a tiny village, like far from everything. And I'm thinking, you are going to tell me I cannot go in here after everybody else has allowed me to enter different museums, different performances.
Okay, and was this the point, by the way, of you having the fake student ID?
Yes.
It was to get into museums. So it's not even to like go, you were doing this for cultural institution
access.
Yes,
because in Belgium, you don't need a fake ID to enter a bar.
It's fair. Okay, I see.
We can enter clubs and bars, you know, no problem.
Right.
I primarily used it actually to enter shows and museums and different sites. Yes, I had this thing about, you know, I'm still a student, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to bullshit this man and he wouldn't let me. But I've often told the story that I actually could get my word in. That I did convince him because I had convinced everybody else.
Right, and you can't accept this one demerit on your record, on your perfect record.
Exactly.
So when you tell the story, you convince the Turkish official.
But, I didn't get in. If I see I get in, I went to buy a freaking stupid ticket. There wasn't the point. It became a sport, you know.
They ruined it all. Well, this has been absolutely wonderful. I love the idea of re-entry through really nice, not controlled, but thoughtful groups of people telling stories with each other to remember who we were and to remember how to speak to each other.
It's only when you go back in person that you realize what you have missed. You can say it, but you don't nearly feel it in such a visceral way when you actually are standing in front of people and someone says, so how was the pandemic?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
Where do you start?
Yeah.
So I said, where should we begin? We start with a game. I'll give you tools to actually not feel like, do you really want to know? Do you want me to really tell you what it was like? Because for some of us, it really wasn't an easy thing. And for others, it was the continuation of a shitty life that we have had all along.
Mm-hmm.
For others, it was the break of every plan. No graduation, no marriage, no anniversary, no this, no that. You know. And for some of us, it's never saying goodbye to the people that passed away, et cetera, et cetera. There is so many stories that people want to tell. And sometimes it's just, I became a voracious reader. I became a voracious bread baker, whatever it is. But there is so many stories. People have been talking to their walls for a while, you know?
Yeah, I think it's so important to acknowledge that we did all have different experiences. And they are more complicated than what the news might convey. Because so many different things happened. We had this political thing happening and we had this incredible pandemic that we didn't know was going to end. And at some points it kind of felt like it wasn't going to end. And so I love that you are giving people tools to talk about it because it seems like we are just rushing forward just culturally. And there doesn't seem to be any space for reflection or mourning or frustration or anger. It's just like, okay, we're opening back up. Take your masks off.
Or reuniting or normalizing or asking people, what happened to you this year?
What happened to you?
You know, what was going on in your family? What about the election? Do you know how many people I'm hearing now about weddings where half the family doesn't come? Because there are entire fissures in the family around the vaccination.
Yes.
What happened around race in your family? What happened around politics in your family? What happened around wildfires in your family?
That's right.
I mean, this was a year. It's just like when you put it together and the general idea sometimes is back to normal, you know, as if this is what people can actually do. You don't go back to normal because you have
That's
a different sense of what is important.
Normal.
And so you actually are doing what you've always done, but with a complete different intensity and intentionality. That's the new normal.
In many ways, we need to re-meet each other.
We have an opportunity to actually meet each other in ways that we often long to, but don't know how to.
Ah, perfect.
Wow. Well, Esther, you have left us with a lot to move forward with. And I know that Tressie and I will probably be playing this game because it's actually really interesting. And I think
it
will, especially at a dinner party, give you something interesting to talk about beyond work. Like, I don't know. I don't think we need to talk about our jobs today. Let's
and
try
it's
something
not
different.
That, that doesn't feel interesting enough either or meaningful enough in these moments. And you know, Esther, I think this is wonderful. We've talked recently on the show how many of us lost friendships during the pandemic. right? Because it just became so much to manage the ties because we just was trying so hard to survive in our own ways. And I'm thinking, Roxanne, I'm going to use this to try to reconvene my friend group.
Oh, that's a beautiful idea.
That's a really great idea. That is a great idea.
So you won't tell them in advance necessarily that you will play, but what you can tell is this. Many of us have lost touch in this past year because it was challenging to actually stay connected to that many. And part of coming back is weaving back those social threads.
Ah, that's exactly, I love that analogy, weaving as it threads back together.
I came to fetch you.
Tressie, you have to let us know how it goes.
I will.
Yeah, and I like what you just said, Esther. I came to fetch you. I think so many people just want to be remembered. Just come acknowledge me. Come get me. I'm ready.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so very much, Esther, for joining us on the show. It has been a joy and a delight.
Same here. It's a pleasure. And I hope we see each other again.
Indeed.
Likewise.
Together and drink with Esther.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And she is very chic in person. When we had lunch with her, she was wearing these beautiful, like, chambray slacks.
Ooh.
I mean, I was just like, we are not the same size. But that said, where did you get those pants? They were really nice.
I love it. We can't link to Esther's pants, but we can link you to information about her card game, Where Should We Begin, which we're going to do in the show notes.
So this is actually our last show of season two of Here to Slay, and we are going to have to call this season our pandemic season because every interview we did and every show we produced took place with COVID and an election happening around us. We recorded at
home. I can't believe we survived this. I honestly can't believe we survived it.
I mean, I don't know how we did it, but well, I do know how we did it. We have had wonderful producers supporting us every step of the way.
That helps tremendously. The conversations kept happening, and we had some really, really good ones. And we want to reminisce with you all about a few of them. Maybe you remember this one. This one was back in November. It was right before Thanksgiving. We were all trying to figure out how we were supposed to have a family meal during the height of COVID shutdowns and lockdowns. We spoke with a chef, Sola El Whaley, who maybe fangirled just a smidge. I think she almost passed out trying to talk to Roxanne. If you remember, she got herself inside a little tent so the sound quality would be good. And she told us how it feels to have made it now that she's a huge YouTube star in the cooking space.
I feel exactly the same. Everybody thinks that I must feel so great and on top of the world, but you know, everything inside my soul is the same. I still feel the same. I think it's going to take a long time to emotionally get past everything. I'm just like really confused. I'm like, why are people nice to me? Why are people listening to what I'm saying? Why am I being treated with respect for the first time?
And hello.
I'm like, I'm very suspicious of all of it, to be honest. I'm like, am I in like the Truman Show and I'm going to find out it's all fake? Because it's been a really dramatic shift. Like overnight, I feel like people are just treating me very differently. And I still feel the same darkness inside.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I really appreciated speaking with Sola for a lot of reasons. One, I was actually familiar with her work well before the whole conflagration over at Bon Appetit, and I really enjoy her way of cooking. But I also liked her frankness in our conversation, that she admitted she was overwhelmed and didn't quite know what to think or how to feel about this newfound public attention, you know, because a lot of people wouldn't admit that, but she did. And she's also like keeping her eyes on what she wants to do. And she was lovely. She really was. And not just because she fangirled.
Absolutely a doll. In December,
again, still in the middle of that holiday season. I think by this time we were all feeling a little drained by the pretense of trying to have the holidays. But we released an episode featuring one of the most delightful men that we have had on the show. You know, we take that very seriously. If you hear a man on Here to Slay, it means he's really, really good. And Jericho Brown is really, really, really good. The election had just happened. The second wave of COVID was building. We began, as we often do, by asking Jericho just how he was feeling about things.
How do I feel at this moment?
Yeah.
You know, we're all on a constant cycle of disappointment with this nation. And disappointment is probably not the exact right word, because it's something lower than that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's something that's sort of, you know, in your gut. Do y'all know what I'm saying?
Yes, where, I do.
Absolutely.
Everything you know to be true, you're suddenly reminded of.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And and I would love to die in a country that loves me.
Oh.
But it looks like I'm not going to get that chance. You know, I'm getting closer and closer.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope for that, right? We would like to all die in a country that we knew was on our side.
Right.
Right. And over and over again, this nation proves itself not to be on our side.
Right.
Yeah.
That one really lingered with me. Mm. When you think about not the country you want to be born into, but the country that you want to die in, the politics of everyday life feel really urgent when you think of it that way. What do we have to do to make this a country, one where I can die in peace?
I think that peace is something we're all looking for. And one of the things that I love about Jericho's poetry is that he shows us the sort of work that he's doing to get to that place. Mm-hmm. And I know that we will definitely have him on again. But February was a red letter month for Here to Slay. We had the wonderful opportunity to speak with country singer Reese Palmer, who spent time in court to get the rights back to her own name as a performer. And it was messy, she said.
Mm. Especially when you can go to Google and find the court transcripts. And like my whole personal life is in, it's on the internet. Mm-hmm. Like it's, because I had to tell the truth about some things in order to get out of my deal. Because nobody was like, everybody was just like, well, it's not that bad. Like, you'll get an advance. I'm like, no, no, no. Like, I have to leave because there's a lot of just not good.
Yeah.
And so I had to show, I had to tell a lot of things that I, like, I had to sit down and have a conversation with my mother before I was able to go into court. Because I was like, some things are going to come out and you need to know this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah, it was traumatic.
Yeah, yeah. Is that why the new album is called Revival?
Yes.
Oh.
That's exactly why. Yes.
Yeah, we're on it and awake sometimes. We can catch. We catch things sometimes. Reese, I've got to tell you, is having a bang up year.
She is.
If you go check Reese out on any of her social media platforms, the racist reckoning that has happened in mainstream country music and pop music writ large has rediscovered anew what many of us always knew, that Reese is a superstar. She's now a host at the country music television, CMT. She did the Country Music Award. She was instrumental in getting the first Black woman country music artist recognized for her lifetime of achievement work at the Country Music Awards this year. Reese's having a bang up year. I hope that that whole traumatic event is far, far, far in her rear view mirror right now, because her girlfriend is having a real moment.
She is. And she seems to be handling it and rising to the occasion, because I, you know, that's what we do as Black women. Whether we want to or not, we stay ready.
Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of staying ready, we spoke with a woman who is trying to keep our little happy asses ready.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ebony Hilton, trying to save us from ourselves. Listen, Dr. Hilton was a hoot, by which I mean she was very depressing because I left that conversation with her. Very concerned. She's an anesthesiologist and an associate professor of anesthesiology and critical care medicine at the University of Virginia Medical Center. She's also fly to death. Talk about being fly. Girlfriend came. She was on one.
She was ready.
that camera turned on and we were like, what the hell?
I think we both immediately wanted to just turn our cameras off.
We did.
Like, don't
we
look did. At me.
I think I remember actually kind of dimming the light in my room a little. I was like, we don't need to see me right now. She's been very outspoken about what the pandemic is doing to communities of color. She reminded us how little we know about COVID.
There's studies now that are coming out that they actually infected rats with COVID to see what happens, mm-hmm. right? And when these rats passed away, they weren't detecting virus any longer in their lungs, mm-hmm. but they were actually detecting the virus in their brains.
That's horrifying to me. Horrible to think.
So for these people who are losing their sense of taste and smell, and people are like, oh, all I did was lose my taste and smell. Yeah, okay. But what does that do?
Right.
That means that virus invaded your neurons. And I don't know why that brings a sense of safety to people, because what does that do to your trajectory of whether or not you're going to develop Parkinson's? What does it do to your trajectory of whether or not you're going to develop Alzheimer's?
That was my first thought. Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. these things are clearly at least originating from the same place. That was my first thought. Like, what mm-hmm. are the waves of neurological diseases we're going to see across the lifespan of, what did you say, 18, 20 million people?
Mm-hmm. And at what age?
Yeah.
If you look at, there were studies at University of Penn that of their athletes who had mild or asymptomatic COVID-19 infection, so barely any symptoms at all, when they did a scan of their heart, they found that 30% of them had inflammation around the heart.
Absolutely, positively horrifying. I think of that interview with Dr. Hilton at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
I do too. Every time I see her on social media, I think, look at her. She is continuing to fight the good fight and especially advocate for us. And I, you know, I don't think she gets nearly enough credit for not only the work she does as a doctor, but the work she does as a public health official.
Yeah, she's a phenomenal science communicator. Absolutely,
yes,
phenomenal.
She is.
Yeah.
She distills what we need and makes it really accessible. Mm-hmm. But we also spoke with a couple of politicians in season two, which is a different way of approaching many of the problems that we talk about on the show. Normally, I think both you and I agree on this, politicians don't make for the best conversations because,
dear God, no.
They just have their little talking points and they don't really want to go beyond the talking point. They don't want to engage mm-hmm. with anything. They don't want to get in trouble. And so they just stick to these talking points and it's like, I don't need to be here for this conversation.
Exactly, exactly.
Elizabeth Warren did have her talking points. In February, she wanted to talk to us about how student loan debt is destroying so many lives. But when Elizabeth Warren talks, there is something incredibly powerful about how she lays her case out.
We need to cancel student loan debt, not only because it's good for all the people who are struggling with student loan debt, mm-hmm. but because it's good for our economy overall.
Mm-hmm.
Even before the pandemic, what mm-hmm. we were seeing is that increasingly young people, because of student loan debt, weren't mm-hmm. buying homes.
Right.
Weren't starting small businesses. Think about that. Because the student loan debt held them back. So I look at it this way. You cancel that student loan debt. It is the single most effective thing that President Biden could do right now
mm-hmm.
to lift this economy up
mm-hmm.
and to lift millions of people up in mm-hmm. this economy.
Unfortunately, Biden still hasn't done a single thing about student loan debt, which is infuriating. Well, I guess he has done that one thing for the for-profit students, which is wonderful and necessary. But still, there are millions of borrowers who are waiting and hoping that this is that moment when they finally do something about this.
As some of our listeners know, my very first book, Lower Ed, was about for-profit colleges, which is bound up in the student loan debt crisis, which is why I spent a lot of my academic career researching and writing and talking about student loan debt, how it's constructed, and why we won't forgive it. And I gotta say, Roxanne, mm-hmm. I was never very hopeful that Biden was going to do mass student loan debt forgiveness. Mm-hmm. I know the people that he's appointed to those committees, and they just do not think of student loan debt as a political problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on us to change. We got to push them on
this. It is. All right. That is our show for this week and for this season.
Yay, season two.
We did it. If you don't already, please do keep up with us on Twitter and Instagram and Gmail at HEAR to Slay to see what happens next.
From Luminary, Here to Slay is executive produced by us, Roxanne Gay and Tressie McMillan Cotton. Our senior producer is Curtis Fox. Our producer is Catherine Finaloza. And our associate producers are Allie McPherson and Isoki Samuel. Production support from Lauren Garcia and Caitlin Adams. We never would have made it through COVID and season two without that team.
Absolutely. Here we are.
Let's hit it. Give me a vacation.
Vacation.
Give me a wave.
Surfing.
Give me a city tour.
The trolley.
Give me animals.
The zoo.
Give me some sea life. Give me museums.
Balboa Park.
Give me a woo.
Roller coaster.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your family vacation at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.